Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscawain. Duncan Wall was not a circus fan growing up. It seemed outdated, tired, his dad's idea of fun. But as an exchange student in Paris, he discovered a new kind of circus and a new world, a style of performance that combined full-body athleticism, storytelling, poetry, theater, and performance. Wall fell in love and found a way to return to Paris to study the circus and learn its many art forms. He enrolled at France's National Circus School, yes, there is such a thing, and describes his experience in his new book, The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus, Past and Present. And he joins us today in studio here on Radio Times. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And before we get to all your personal adventures with juggling and being a clown and flying the trapeze, I want to get to a bit of the circus history, which you describe in your book. So what are the origins of the circus?
Well, the circus actually goes very, very, very far back. There aren't precise origins. We talk about the circus arts before there was actually the circus. They go back at least 3000 BC. I have a historian mentor named Pascal Jacob, who I talk about in the book, and he has an image that he likes to evoke of in the cave where the cavemen are sitting around and they're around the fire and the shadows are being cast on the wall. That might have been the first circus, that there was a sense of the ring, the magic, the spectacle. Acrobatics itself, 3000 BC in China. There are tombs in Egypt with jugglers on the walls. Clowning in Rome was quite popular. It really was everywhere, as far back as we know.
But then when does the actual circus that we think of, the tent, the elephants, that kind of thing, when does that start?
Sure, yeah. So during the Middle Ages, there were the kind of traditions continued in the fairgrounds that kind of split the circus arts. In 1768, a British cavalier by the name of Philip Astley came to London. And at the time, there was equestrian theater going on. So it was a lot of former cavaliers who were interested in doing theater because they had got into the war and needed to make some money, and so they were now performing their stunts. He saw that. He thought that was interesting. He created his own show and then brought in fairground performers, added them to the equestrian theater in a ring, and thus the circus was born.
So it was horses plus.
Horses plus.
And okay.
And that was the case for a long time. It was really a horse-based art.
And how quickly did the idea catch on, to put on this kind of performance, to bring people and to have it travel?
It's interesting. So, I mean, circus itself caught on right away. If you look at the history, it's fascinating. In the first 50 years, basically it spread from London around Europe and then around the world very, very quickly, almost unprecedented. It caught on in London right away. There were imitators of Philip Astley, much to his chagrin. They set up circuses. He traveled himself, set up circuses in Paris, all over. The development of the traveling circus didn't come until later. That was in the 19th century, actually.
And can you compare, just to give us a sense, to today's entertainment? People go to football games, hockey games, if they can afford it. What was the circus? Back then, there was a much more limited, you know, choice in terms of entertainment.
Yeah. I mean, the circus really was, for a period in Europe and in America, and it depends on the century you're talking about, but in the 19th century, it was one of the most popular art forms in the world. It was where you went to at once meet your neighbors, at once to see people perform amazing events, experiences, at once to see an artistic experience, because the circus at that point was highbrow and artistic. It was also where you went to get the news. In the book, I recount a story of actually Madame Saki, who was around during Napoleon's period, and she would go to the battlefields, figure out what was happening on the battlefield, see the battles themselves, and then come back and reenact the battles on her tightrope in Paris. And the idea was that there was no TV, there was no internet, you had to experience it firsthand, and you did that through the circus.
And what were people shelling out back then to see a performance? Was it expensive, affordable?
It depends. I mean, it really depends. There are some circuses that were basically very, very inexpensive. There were also very expensive circuses. In Paris, the circus was sometimes held in opera houses, something like opera houses, where the Shah would come to Paris and he'd visit. And as part of that, his visit, he would go to the circus. You'd put on your top hat at night and you'd put on your beautiful gown and you'd go down to the circus and meet Henry James or meet, you know, the most popular writer of the day or the newest aristocrat. So those were obviously slightly more expensive.
And I want to get later on in the show, I want to get to some of your descriptions of the early circus artists, some very colorful personalities there. But before we get to that, what did you think of the circus growing up?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because I, as a kid, I had the internet. right? So, and I had television, and I had all of these things that were part of the modern experience. And as a result, when I went to a circus, it felt kind of outdated. It felt antiquated. It was kind of it was interesting in a sort of nostalgic sense. I remember when I was a kid, I used to watch Nick at Night with my parents, and it had a bit of the same feeling. Like, I felt like, okay, this can be interesting. My Three Sons is kind of interesting, but it's not interesting for me. So the circus was a bit that. We would go every once in a while. I remember us going to an arena downtown and seeing the kind of animals from a distance, seeing a trapezist in a sequined outfit, and not really understanding what it was all about.
And then you go to Paris, first as an exchange student, and you had these kind of chaperoned cultural events, and one of them was to go to a circus. What did you even think?
Yeah, it really was that. It was like, I was there to study philosophy and cinema. I was there to sort of pursue my life outside. I had no relationship to the circus whatsoever. They took us to the Louvre, they took us to the Musée d'Orsay, and then they said, we're going to go to a modern circus. And I said, well, I don't know what that is. I should probably go. It was unlike anything I'd ever experienced theatrically. It was something between physical theater and dance and the kind of traditional circus that I knew, the circus arts, but it had nothing. There was nothing in common sort of representationally, artistically. It was dark. It was kind of brooding. There were people yelling in Simon and Garfunkel lyrics. They were quoting Proust. I remember there's a juggler who comes on stage, and he kind of looks at you ferociously, and he has these oranges in his hands, and he starts juggling the oranges, and as he's juggling them, he's ripping them apart, and he's bashing them against his face, right, against his forehead, so the orange juice is splashing all over him. And you know, I'm sitting in the third row. It's like, what is this? Like, this is circus? I had no idea. And I kind of fell in love with it. And it was funny, because at that time, too, I remember thinking, like, this show is so amazing, right? Like, who is this company? Who are these people creating the show? And then I came to find out that it wasn't just this show, that actually it's this whole other art form that I had never seen before.
So then you started just going and going and going, right?
Yeah. Then I just started attending shows and meeting people. And what was amazing about the whole scene is that in Paris there's a very and we have it in Montreal where I teach as well, but in Paris there's a very interesting circus scene that you can access easily. You can meet the artists. You can get into it. It's very open and welcoming. And so I started plunging into it, and I ended up finding out about a national circus school, and the rest is sort of history.
Yes. So we're talking with Duncan Wall. He has written The Ordinary Acrobat, about the history of the circus and his time at the National Circus School of France. And if you want to join the conversation, if you are a circus fan, maybe have your own experiences, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499. So you return to France on a Fulbright scholarship, and you enroll at the National Circus School. What were you thinking?
Yeah, good. Very good question. I mean, it was... When I first heard about the school, it was a bit like you said in your introduction. It's like, oh, that exists. Like, France has a national circus school. Like, what is, you know? And even the idea of a circus school, because we have this popular conception of circus being something that you grow up in, right? And that you could actually learn to be in the circus was new for me. So I applied for the Fulbright. It was a bit of a shock, because the Fulbright being what it is, I thought it was a long shot. It was almost like a joke. It was like, oh, they would never send me to circus school on a Fulbright. And then they did. It's like, great. It was also, but it was more than, I should say, I mean, I say that sort of humbly, but it was also more than an experience at circus school. It really was my attempt to understand what was going on and try to make sense of, okay, like, why is it that this art form is all over Europe? And it really is all over Europe today. Why is it so cool? Like, why did I, like, and I mean that in a sort of real raw way. Well, how did it get so cool? Why did I respond to it so strongly? And why had I never heard about it? Why had it sort of not punctured America yet?
So let's talk about this art form, the modern circus, because the circus as we know it did hit a decline as mass media started to come in. People stopped going. So what happened to the circus for some time?
I guess it might be helpful to sort of try to define what the modern circus is. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit like if we think about ballet, right? Ballet has costumes. Ballet has shows that you go to. You know, you go to Swan Lake. There are certain codes of ballet. When is ballet dance? Of course, right? Is ballet the only dance? Of course not. There are other types of dance. What happened with the circus is, imagine the circus before as kind of like ballet. It was a certain type of circus, right? But it became the circus as we know it. In the 60s and 70s, the codes, right? So the costumes, everything else began to be stripped away and replaced by a circus that was at once freer, perhaps more creative, more modern, more in the sense that it spoke to its time. You had storyline, you had things like meaning. So the idea was to actually give a circus act a piece of meaning, as opposed to just, you know, doing a backflip to be spectacular or to show that you can do it. Now I'm doing a backflip to express something about myself, about the world.
And what happens to the animals, which were a big part of the circus as we knew it growing up?
Absolutely. I mean, if, especially in the past, the animals were so important, because imagine if you're living in the middle of America and you are living in this little town by yourself, and you've maybe seen a picture of an elephant, right? You've maybe heard about a juggler, and then the circus comes to town. Seeing an elephant in that context was extraordinary. It was absolutely spectacular. As the 20th century evolved and we had things like cinema, that became less spectacular in the immediate sense, right? So the modern circus tended to do away with that. It tended to put the emphasis on the human body, on human creation, on human virtuosity. Today, most modern circuses, especially in Europe, don't use animals. Some use domesticated animals, so dogs and horses. But the emphasis is really for partly moral reasons and partly economic reasons on the human body, and like, what can we express through what we're doing?
Do you think the modern circus also elevates the circus to an art form, or has it always been an art form? What's your take on that?
I think there have always been artists in the circus. It depends on what we mean by art. And it's funny, because in writing the book, a lot of what I kind of surprising to me, what I came to explore was this notion of art, right? The fact that the circus wasn't entertainment for a long time. It was accepted as a, quote, entertainment, and now it's being talked about as an art. In France, you see literally the government making a designation of the circus as an art form. Same thing's happening in Canada. That begs the question, you know, what is art? How does something go from being a low art to a high art, or an entertainment to an actual art form? One of the conclusions I come to in the book is that there are all sorts of things that make an art, but one of them is work, and one of them is putting in a lot of work. And that's something that the circus has always had. The people who worked in the circus worked very, very hard, and they were very serious about the craft.
So before we go to our break, where does Cirque du Soleil comes to mind? Where does that fit in the modern circus movement?
Sure. They were part of the movement when things changed in the 60s and 70s. They saw that in Europe. They were actually traveling around Europe, Guy Laliberté and some of the other founders. They saw that. They brought it back to North America. In 1984, they began their circus in Montreal. It was at first a small group of fire breathers and jugglers and, you know, guys on the streets. It was very kind of rough. They got some government money. The government of Quebec supported them. They snowballed that into their first show. They went to Los Angeles. They blew up. And then they went to Vegas, and they blew up even bigger, and they've been blowing up ever since.
Yep, and they are huge. We're talking with Duncan Wall. His new book is The Ordinary Acrobat, about his time becoming a circus performer and also about the history of the circus. We're hoping that you'll join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back with more after a short break here on Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, the Designer, Craftsman, and Historic Home Shows, March 8th through the 10th at the Valley Forge Convention Center. Tickets online at historichomeshows.com or 800-826-3893, extension 2209.
Phoebe Ministries supports WHYY with communities in Lehigh, Berks, Bucks, and Montgomery counties. Phoebe specializes in healthcare, housing, and services for senior adults. April 10th, the Phoebe Institute on Aging presents An Interfaith View of the Spiritual Aspects of Aging and Dying, featuring Rabbi Dale Friedman and leaders of multiple faith traditions. The conference provides spiritual leaders, healthcare, and human services professionals the opportunity to learn about the aging process across cultures. Details at phoebe.org/PIA.
The budgetary discussions currently taking place in Washington present challenges for people in our community and for WHYY. Yet, at the same time, we have continued to expand our services. I'm Bill Morazzo. Your support to WHYY in the last 5 years has offset government losses, yet resulted in the growth of the services you rely on. A donation today will enable us to continue to fulfill our promise to you. Visit WHYY.org to make a donation.
Supporting WHYY, Clean Currents, helping businesses and residents reduce their carbon footprint with clean, local Pennsylvania wind power. To learn more about the region's only certified B Corporation electricity supplier, windpowerpa.com.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking with Duncan Wall. He has written The Ordinary Acrobat about the history of the circus and his time at the National Circus School of France. And Duncan, before our break, so we were talking about the fact that you were an exchange student in France, fell in love with the modern circus, then went back to the States, got a Fulbright scholarship, and then came back, and then you started at the National Circus School of France. So describe your first day.
The first day was surprising. I mean, I didn't even know what to wear.
Right.
I had no, like, what do you wear at a circus school? Is it like yoga? Is it like soccer? I bought a white t-shirt and I bought some black sweatpants, and that worked out quite well. We had the first day a test, actually, to sort of figure out where we were acrobatically. I was in a program with, I think it was four other students, and I should be clear, too, that it was the preparatory program, so the actual schools themselves are very, very competitive. This notion, I could never have even dreamed of entering the school just sort of having never done anything. They put me in a year that allowed me to develop skills in the hopes that I could enter, take the big full test at the end of the year. And in the book, it's me leading up to that moment, leading up to taking the test. They gave us a test that first day to see where we're at. I failed miserably. I failed everything miserably.
Were you athletic?
I had done soccer a lot. I had done some martial arts, right? I had done a certain forms of athleticism. Acrobatics is completely different. The skills that you need to be an acrobat, the kind of full body awareness and ability is unlike anything I'd ever done. So, you know, I mean, we had just like, how long can you hold a handstand? And, well, I can't do a handstand. We'll try. Well, okay, that didn't go very well. How's your backflip? Well, I can't do a backflip. We'll try. Well, okay, that didn't go very well. I remember they had actually a score sheet where it was like, you get 1-0 is the lowest, 7 is the perfect. Mine looked like a kind of, you know, binary code. It was like 0-1-0-0-0-0-0-1-0-0-1. And then everybody was sort of like nodding, like, okay, well, we'll see how this goes.
So were you scared at this point? Embarrassed? I mean, you're also in front of people. I always get embarrassed in those situations.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was totally embarrassed. And it's funny because in the whole experience of the circus, for me, and I actually think, as I'm saying this, it speaks to a lot of people who do the circus, you learn to get over that, right? You learn that, for instance, learning how to do a back handspring is a process that takes a long, long time. And all you can do is take the necessary steps, develop slowly, and do your best. The funny thing about the school is just this big room, right? And in the big room, everybody was working together. So all of your humiliations were very public humiliations. If you fell and you landed wrong and you sort of grunted in an embarrassing way, everybody would hear that. Everybody would turn and look, and there'd be this kind of like, what's going on over there? And you'd sort of pull yourself up off the mat. So yeah, it was very embarrassing.
So what did you start with? Handstand?
No, you start at the very bottom. So you started with a somersault. And that's kind of amazing that you know, I talk about it in the book, this notion that in the circus, there's a hierarchy of movements, right? And you need to start at the very beginning because the movements have to be done in a very specific way. Doing a somersault the way that, you know, I would do one here in the studio if you would let me, or on a beach or something, would be very different than the way that I might have done one 5 years ago, simply because I've now been trained to do a correct somersault.
Okay, so you had to relearn a lot of movements in this process. What was the toll this took on your body?
At first it was rough. At first there was a lot of soreness. There was a lot of bruising, I think. I don't want to make it sound dramatic, though, but there is a moment in most circus artists where you feel it in your body. Then your body gets used to it. You become better at it. By the end, I was in the best shape of my life. I remember looking in the mirror one time and being like, wow, those are my shoulders. Like, I never had shoulders like that. That's great. Like,
but yet you're not a huge guy, no offense. You're built, but you're still slim. So yeah. it doesn't bulk you up.
No, it's what I notice among my students at the school too, is there's kind of like a circus body, right? And it is the sort of full, they're flexible, they're muscular. But they're not bulky in the sense because they don't need extra weight. Because, and think about it, if you're doing a cord lease, which is a rope act, right? And you climb up on your rope, you have to be up on that rope for 4 minutes. So supporting yourself on that rope, you have to at once be strong enough to do it, but you also don't want any extra weight because any extra weight is going to be harder for you. And that's really quite common in the circus. You have people who are they have muscular endurance, they have cardio, they have kind of everything, which is why it's such a great amateur activity too.
What's the role of fear? Can you be a fearful person and still do this kind of thing? And how do you learn to overcome and to override when your body tells you, no, don't do that?
That's a really good question. Yeah, it's something that every circus artist and everybody doing amateur circus deals with every day. That's part of what makes it thrilling, right? It's also part of what makes it hard. When you're doing a back handspring, for instance, and you throw yourself backwards, right? There is this.
I'm wincing.
She just winced. everything inside you screams no, 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 right? Because it's so unnatural to be doing something like that, throwing yourself backwards. There are small steps that you can take, right? So they're in French they're called éducatifs, like little educationals. So the first thing I would do, they had me do, is just throw myself backwards into this big mat. So again and again, right? And not even like trying to flip, just throwing yourself backwards in order to break some of those mental barriers. Then they'll have you sort of do lots of back bends, right? So that you're bending over backwards and you can get the sense of what the position might feel like. And gradually working up. That said, the fear never goes away. And it's something that I explored with other performers. A lot of what I talk about in the book is this notion of who are the artists of today and how are they responding to their work. And so lots of conversations. And one of them was about fear. And, you know, even for me now, when I see somebody do a triple backflip, it's like, well, you know, I would wince the way you just winced, right? It's like that would be crazy. And the performers largely tell me that no, there's still this element of fear. What you need to do is you need to control the fear. It's not about getting rid of the fear; it's about managing the fear. And how do you do that?
And you described several situations where your body reacted in a certain way, either instinctively or because that's how your body always reacted, and it creates a problem.
Yeah,
like on the trapeze, for example. Describe your experience with the trapeze, because your first time you did it, it was quite dramatic, right?
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because it's the first time you do anything, it's always this rush of adrenaline and kind of panic. And my experience in the trapeze was especially that. And this is actually before I went to the circus school. I went to a trapeze workshop, kind of curious, and they sent me up, and there was, I think it was a language thing, but there was some miscommunication, and the understanding was that I had done this before. And I was either too scared or didn't notice enough to correct them. And so they sent me off in the trapeze without the harness belt. And then it was just sort of me, like, I started to scream. I think I started screaming.
Were you hanging from?
I was hanging from the bar. I didn't quite, you know, because it's happening so quickly. And then, I didn't really realize that I was just hanging until I was hanging. And then it was like, sort of shaking a little bit. And the guy at the bottom realized very quickly what was going on. And that they had made a grave mistake. And that everybody, it was in everybody's best interest to get me down as quickly as possible. So I just sort of went limp. And then it sort of, I mean, it's this funny image of me just sort of going limp gradually and swinging to slower and slower stop, and then I dropped into the net.
Okay. We have a call, actually, Ronnie calling in from Atlantic City, who wants to talk to you. Hi, Ronnie. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. This has really been fascinating because my son's a performer. In fact, he was with Circus Schmirkus.
Yeah, great.
Sometime.
It's a wonderful organization.
They're wonderful. Thank you. And he... What he did, he's a juggler, unicyclist, all of that, and I think it's the discipline of it. I happen to be a special educator, and I know juggling is good for balancing the brain. Mm-hmm. What he did is he applied his juggling and all of the other skills he has to going to school for the last 20 years and teaching kids about the environment through Earthcapades, and it has been wonderful. I mean, I sometimes will travel around to those schools and see them perform and see how children learn and engage and grow from the skills of the circus.
Ronnie,
so
thank you.
I found it fascinating.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Ronnie. I want to make a quick plug because on our website at newsworks.org, we have a great video of a fourth grade class who has been using the circus and the circus arts to learn other disciplines within the school. So if people want to check that out. But I guess something that Ronnie brings up, which you also talk a lot about in the book, is the kind of connection between the physical and the mental aspects of the work, whether it's juggling or learning to fly on the trapeze or any of that. Describe that a bit. What do you have to learn in your head to do all those things?
Well, it's funny. It depends on the context. And in one sense, the reason that the circus works so well and the reason that, that programs like Ronnie emerged are because it's this beautiful mix of sport and art, right? So kid, and even myself, like I grew up reading books, I grew up writing, and I grew up doing soccer. I found that I responded very strongly to both of those. In that sense, when you're doing something physically, you also have to be thinking because it's creative, right? And the whole goal of circus today is not to sort of learn how to do a backflip. It's not gymnastics, right? It's learning how to do a piece of physical movement and then expressing yourself through that movement. So there's all sorts of kind of mental connotations involved that, that are exciting for young people and old people alike. In terms of the kind of acts themselves, there's also, as we were talking about before, the notion of controlling your fear. There's the notion of in basically proprioception, right, which is how your body's awareness of itself in space and dictating that, and that's all mental.
Mm-hmm. And you describe you trying to learn how to juggle. So at first, it's very difficult. Describe how you got started.
How did I get started? Juggling is a funny thing now because I've taught, like, I could teach you to juggle right now in this hour probably. Like, I've taught so many people to juggle that the process of getting started is almost a non. We just start, right? And you start with one ball, and you start by throwing the ball back and forth between your hands. And then you add a second ball, and you throw that back and forth in a certain pattern, and then eventually you add a third ball, and then you just do it. It's really, this is the kind of beautiful thing, and it touches on something that Ronnie brought up. The circus arts were, for literally thousands of years, a part of a family discipline, right? So you grew up in the circus. Part of the revolution that occurred in the 70s was that the circus arts came out of the families and started and integrated into the world, right? So the circus opened up. Literally in 1974... I should say in 1973, there were no circus schools in Europe. In 1974, there were two. Today, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And France alone has 600, right? Which is kind of fascinating when you think about it. It's like, here's this art form that's been around, as we talked about in the beginning, for thousands and thousands of years. It was completely kind of closed off. And then only 30 years ago, it's opened up, right?
And are these private schools, public schools?
Both, yeah. They are, you know, again, like to put it in context, France is roughly the size of Texas, right? 600 schools. So imagine every little town in Texas having a circus school. It's completely integrated in the society over there. You go, some of them are professional schools, like the one I went to in Paris. Some of them are recreational schools. Some of them are kind of what we call social circuses. So it's a bit what she was talking about, using circus for social good. So kids in the inner city in France or elsewhere, and these programs exist in America too, will go to the circus after school because it provides an outlet, because it teaches them skills like self-esteem, teamwork, community building.
Mm-hmm. Now take us back to the juggling. So is it in your head or is it a physical thing? What's your concentration level when you do it?
It's both, and this is what's beautiful about the circus. It's in your head and it's physical in the same way that rock climbing is or yoga is. It's a fully participatory experience. With the juggling, there's a lot of. It's actually somebody gave me a great lesson. They said, you know, try signing your name with your. We did this for circus students, right? So try signing your name with your left hand, right? And you do, and you realize it's kind of weird. You like to do it with your right hand. Okay, go back to your left hand, and that feeling that just. There's a kind of lack of familiarity with the gesture that you're so familiar with your right hand it feels odd in your left hand. When you're learning a new physical skill, it's the same way, right? When you're learning to juggle, it's the same way. Your juggling hands are both left hands, and you're learning how to move them correctly. It was a good school for circus students because sometimes it's now so easy for them and so natural for them that they forget that, in fact, it's actually kind of hard.
So for some people, you describe juggling becomes an obsession, where you juggle everything. You go to the supermarket and you juggle things and you can't stop.
Yeah, this is real. It's completely real. Every serious juggler I know went through a period where they would sneak out of their room at night and, you know, go down to the basement while their parents were sleeping and juggle in the basement over their bed so that the balls would fall in the bed and not hit the ground and wake their parents. I mean, there's a sense of, like, kind of obsession.
What is it? Is it that much fun, or is it needing that, craving the physical motion of things? What is it?
I think it's a lot of things. It's, you know, when you talk to jugglers, what they'll tell you, especially the serious jugglers, is it's at once physical, right? So it's something you're doing physically, but it's also mental. And so it becomes this kind of problem, right? It's clear what to do. When you learn a new trick, you're learning something specific and clear. And you can just keep going. Like there's nobody stopping you. You are in complete control. You have this kind of world in your hands that you can discover and explore. The other thing that's kind of interesting is there are studies beginning to emerge, as Ronnie talked about the relationship between juggling and the brain. There's a notion of flow, which is basically being immersed in an activity. And it turns out as juggling is one of these activities that really generates a strong feeling of flow and allows you to just think of the juggling act, right? It's sort of dynamic, but it's also continuous, so you can keep going.
It seems almost like a meditation.
It can be. And there are. I mean, there's actually a book called Zen and the Art of Juggling.
Of course, there has to be a book.
There are people who latch onto that very strongly.
What happens, you talk in the book about, you know, that you drop the ball, and every juggler on occasion drops the ball. How does that happen? Is it a lapse in concentration? Is it a small mistake? How does it happen to you when you drop the balls?
Interesting. I think it's if you ask a really high level circus performer, it's either that you're working beyond your technique, right? So you have a certain technique and you are trying something that you just can't do, and so you're going to drop it every once in a while because it's too difficult for you. It can also be a lack of concentration. It can be that momentarily in your brain something distracted you, or some other thing, you know, created a kind of flash, and you pull out of it. One interesting thing that I sometimes hear from professional performers is that it's actually that the shows that are the hardest are those in which, and I think it was a Cirque du Soleil performer told me this, their mothers are in the audience, right? Because you, or your wife is in the audience. There's some other little thing, this little bug in your head that's distracting you from what you're doing.
You also juggled with a great master of that arm, Jerome Thomas in France. Tell us about him. What's he like?
Jerome is a legend. I mean, Jerome is a person unto himself. I mean, he came up as a kind of cabaret juggler. And so again, the story of the modern circus is about these circus arts becoming creative, becoming expressive. Jerome started, he's about maybe late 40s now. He started as a cabaret juggler, sort of standard, you know, this little 3-minute act. But he was an artist in his soul, right? As he talks about, he was always interested in dancing, moving. So as he developed as a performer, he started including more and more dance into his work. He started including more and more movement into his work. Now he doesn't really even think of juggling as tricks in any kind of codified sense. It's simply moving with objects. So when I go with him, and I took a juggling lesson with him, spent the day with him, he really enforced on me this idea that juggling isn't trying to keep the balls in the air. It's not trying to move the balls even in a specific way. It's trying to move with the objects as if you were dancing with them.
And I saw, after reading your book, I went to YouTube and I saw some of his performances, and they are very just beautiful and striking, and so much is happening all at once.
Yeah, they're completely poetic. They're touching. They're impressive. I mean, that's one of the things that I would encourage the listeners to do, and I encourage all my friends to do. You know, whenever I have the conversation of, oh, you know, what, you know, you're the circus guy. You know, what's modern circus? It's like, oh, here, watch these clips. Right. Go to the YouTube, find the clips. All the artists are on there, because you really can't, you know, you can't understand the modern circus until you've seen the kind of how beautiful and expressive it can be.
And he taught you to literally move around while juggling, right?
That's right. Yes, he has a whole system where it's like, you know, he calls it Spectre. It's like his movement in space through juggling, and it's a curriculum that you learn as to how to move with objects. And I should emphasize too that juggling today is not really, they call it juggling, but they also call it object manipulation. And the notion is that you're not just moving balls or kind of bowling pins or whatever you want to call them. You can do anything. So we could do a juggling show right here with this Kleenex box and that mug and my book.
I have seen him with a plastic bag.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're talking with Duncan Wall. He has a new book called The Ordinary Acrobat, which describes his time in France, where he went to a circus school to learn more about being a circus artist, and also describes the rich history of the circus and some of the people who are in it today in the modern circus movement. We can take your calls at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499, and we'll be right back with more here on Radio Times.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Do your drinking habits cause problems in your personal or professional life? Do you drink to cope with stress? These may be signs of alcohol dependence. UPenn is conducting a research study using naltrexone, an FDA-approved medication for use in treating alcoholism. If you are 18 or older, have an alcohol problem, and want to reduce your drinking, you may qualify for the study. Details at 215-222-3200, extension 156.
On the next Fresh Air, a history of the FBI's secret intelligence gathering operations based on 70,000 recently declassified documents. We talk with Tim Weiner about his book, Enemies. It reveals J. Edgar Hoover's secret operations against U.S. citizens he suspected were anarchists, communists, communist pawns, radical leftists, or homosexuals. Join us.
Today at 3 and again at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Weather-related disasters and insurance. Are homeowners ready when earthquakes or major storms like Sandy strike? An expert in risk says no. Also, the Oscar-nominated documentary on AIDS activists who help change medicine. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking with Duncan Wall. He has written The Ordinary Acrobat about the history of the circus and his time at the National Circus School of France. And Duncan, we've talked a lot about all the different skills you learned while at the school. But it's not just about the physical aspect of being an artist and a performer. What else do they teach at the National Circus School?
And that's it's fascinating because it speaks to what we were talking about earlier with this notion of the circus being somehow now a creative discipline, being an artistic discipline. It really is an art school in the fullest sense. When you arrive, they want to teach you, and we think of ourselves a bit this way in Montreal, we want to teach you how to be creative. We want to teach you how to be an artist. So in France, they would take the kids to the most progressive theater shows they could. They would take them to workshops with the National School of Beaux-Arts, of like the visual arts, right? They would have sculptors come in to work with them. They would have cinematographers come in to work with them. They would have choreographers come in to work with them. This whole notion of how do you, you know, especially if an art form that didn't exist, how do you create that art form? How do you generate artists? Philosophy, literature, all of it, in order to kind of be somebody who has something to say.
Now, you went to their prep program, but who gets into the real program, so to speak?
It's the best. I mean, it's like it's the Juilliard of the circus, as is the school in Montreal where I teach. It's really the top level. So there's a whole pyramid. You start when you're young in schools, the way you play soccer or yoga or anything, and you work your way up gradually, getting to hopefully the day when you can apply for the national school and get in. I met a young woman last night at an event in New York that we were doing. That she is 20 years old. She 2 years ago she decided that she wanted to be a circus artist, and now she's in the process of going through this education. And we talked about what she can be doing and how she could be where she needs to be going, getting training, et cetera, et cetera.
How many students do they take a year, and how long is the program?
In France, it's roughly 15 students. It's 4 years, so it's 2 years at the school where I was, and then 2 years at the Centre National des Arts du Cirque, the next level. They come from all over the world. I mean, I had kids in my year. It was Finland, Sweden, Spain, Portugal, Brazil, coming to learn how to be circus artists.
So after you go through the prep school, did you take the big test? What happens next?
should I give away the book? spoiler alert! I did not take the test. Basically, I decided that at the end it was I don't know, that performing wasn't the thing that interested me most, and that I didn't have the kind of passion that I had come to understand was necessary from the artists I was meeting, that you really had to be willing to dedicate your life to and throw yourself into it.
Let's take another call. We have Jennifer joining us from Princeton, New Jersey. Hi, Jennifer. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Hello.
Good, thank you.
Hi. I am, saying I'm a circus performer might be putting it a little too grandiosely, but I took up circus arts, aerials, about a year and a half ago at the age of 57.
Awesome.
And I'm not skinny and tiny. Do you know I'm a big human? And so there was I knew and I was prepared for that there would be a lot of physical work that had to be done, but the amount of mental work, I mean, when you're hanging from your knees from the trapeze upside down and someone says, put your hands up, what do you do? Do you know? That's just one of the simple little things I had to figure out. Is it up like the way I always think up is, like on the other side of my head, or is it up toward the ceiling? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like you're upside down and you're not used to thinking upside down.
And Jennifer, what got you into that?
Oh, well, a friend of mine, I ran into her one day, and she told me, I asked her what's new. She says, I have a new tightrope. And I was like, what? So she showed me, and then she told me about what she was doing. She was actually the wife of a colleague, so not a really good friend. And she showed me this rigging she had in her backyard. She taught children. She taught kids, and she didn't have any ability to teach adults. But she did let me try the equipment, and I have never been so physically challenged nor had so much fun in my entire life. And so I was completely hooked. And so she sent me to a school in Hillsborough that was just opening up.
All right. Jennifer, thank you so much for sharing that experience and for your call. And it seems like there is that bug that you catch. You describe that. One of the circus historians you quote says it. You catch the circus bug and you can't. You can't shake it.
Yeah, they call it getting sawdust in your shoes in the old circus, right? And this is why people would run away with it, why people would sort of find their lives in it. What's different now is that you don't have to run away, right? You can take a class the way. I mean, you can be 57 in Princeton, or I know an aerialist in Philly actually here who's over 70, who discovered this and wanted to get involved. There's a level for everybody. There's also something about the circus, kind of the mythology of it, that is still true today, and that's it's a place of unity through diversity. So there's a place for everyone. Maybe you're not the biggest person, right? Maybe you're not a strong person. Maybe you're kind of skinny and kind of clumsy. Well, you can be a clown, right? Maybe you are overweight, maybe a little bit, or maybe you're a big bone person. The circus still needs you, right? We need you to hold other people and support other people.
Did you feel immediately welcome? You came to France as an American. Were there any language issues, any issues at all, or is this just a very welcoming environment?
I think the circus in general is very welcoming. The language was an issue. It's also funny because I feel like I grew up in the middle of America. I grew up in St. Louis. I had American notions of what art was, what philosophy was, kind of ways of thinking, kind of Anglo and concrete. The French are not that way. The French are more abstract in there. They have a different attitude toward art that I really came to respect and revere. But there was certainly a transition period where I would hear somebody talking about juggling the way that you would talk about, you know, like a kind of modernist philosophy from the 20s. And I didn't really get it. Like, I was like, what does this mean? How are we talking about this? And so ultimately, though, I came to understand and respect that viewpoint.
Now, the graduates of the National Circus School of France, where do they go? Can they make a living? Can you make money being a circus performer these days?
Absolutely. There's actually an article in the, I think it was the Star in Canada, just about a week or two ago, about how the school up there can't produce enough graduates. There really is kind of this booming market and need for circus performers. You make very good money. The school in Montreal where I teach has a job acceptance, job placement rate of 95%. The school in France is roughly the same. And it's partly because it's this new art form in a sense that there aren't tons and tons of circus performers who've been around for a long time.
And you also take the best of the best.
Yeah. I mean, we are the Juilliard, so that helps. But I know lots and lots of aerialists, lots and lots of clowns, lots and lots of jugglers who are living by their art, who didn't go to ENC, where I teach, was the National School of Canada, or study in France. And what's a bit different from circus from other art forms is, and it's something that we at once is an advantage, but also can become a disadvantage, is that you're allowed to perform. There's a call for you to perform not just in theaters, not just in a kind of performance setting, but also in corporate workshops, corporate kind of, what do they call those, galas, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're having an aerialist hanging above a crowd at a cabaret, at a club. And those are often well-paid gigs.
Now, you mentioned clowns, and this is something you also became very passionate about. What were your notions about clowns before you got emerged into this world?
It was everybody's notions of clowns today still. I mean, it was the red nose, the kind of cloying, puerile humor. It was that kind of, you know, clowns tripping over themselves, their big shoes and the pants. And the
slapstick.
The bozo image.
And then what did you learn?
I learned that the clowning... It's a bit like the same with circus in general, right? That we're talking about this evolution of the circus into the contemporary circus. If you strip away all of those codes of clowning, if you strip away the red nose, if you strip away the pants and everything else, what you ultimately have is a kind of way of being. You have a kind of way of address. And what a clown does is a clown presents himself or herself as vulnerable as possible and tries to be as open and with the audience as possible. At the risk of embarrassing himself, and actually hopefully embarrassing himself, in order to get a laugh. But that takes a real kind of sense of, I mean, it's psychologically very complex, and the clowns I know are very complex people because of it, and pretty admirable. They're able to at once be themselves fully in a way that's hard.
But be yourself while in a costume, and sometimes hidden behind makeup or...
Many clowns don't use makeup today, and in fact the majority don't. And I think a clown, what a clown would tell you, a kind of professional clown would tell you, that actually you're being an exaggerated version of yourself, right? So if you, for instance, have like one clown I know had really long arms, right? So she then instead of trying to hide that, that becomes kind of, you know, it's not a bug, it's a feature, right? That becomes part of her costume and her act. So she wore a really short shirt that actually showed all of her arms. You know, the idea is to find everything that kind of embarrasses you and actually try to be proud of it and show it off in order to kind of create a character of yourself.
Can you learn that? I'm thinking juggling, probably everybody can learn, maybe even walking on a tightrope. But can you learn to be a clown, or do you have to have some clown in you?
Or do we all have clowns in us? You know, like there's this idea that's quite powerful and popular called the inner clown, right? And so a lot of clown training isn't necessarily learning how to, you know, fall in a certain way. It's learning how to access that inner clown, learning how to find out who you are when you're being your most vulnerable self.
So what did you do to become a clown? Mm-hmm. This is something you pursued professionally then for several years.
Yeah, I had a clown theater company. I took workshops. I mean, basically, clowning is tough. It's a discipline that takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of experience. So you have to, often it's structured, the education happens in workshops. So you'll do a workshop for like a weekend, then you'll go away and you'll work on your act or yourself, come back, do another workshop. I did a number of those workshops, and then we started creating work. So creating kind of clown-based theater work.
Describe your clown performance and your troupe that you have.
I thought you were going to ask me to describe my inner clown.
We can get there.
Right. That's next hour on Radio Times. It was kind of macabre. It was a bit, I mean, the publicity, we called it Cirque Coen Brothers meets Marx Brothers meets Cirque du Soleil or something, right? So it was you know, the one of the gags was that I had attempted to kill my partner, right, and stabbed him in the back, but it didn't really work. So he was still alive. So he had a knife sticking out of his back, right, but he didn't know it was there. So the whole show, and it was a full length show, right, circulated around this notion that he's walking around with a knife in his back and he doesn't know it's there, and the kind of gradual realization that A, he has a knife in his back, and B, I did it, and why.
And what is your inner clown? I had to go there.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's a little bit, I mean, it's kind of...
But who are you when you say at your most vulnerable? What are those things that you explore? You don't have long arms. So,
yeah, yeah.
So what is it?
I had kind of a tight walk. Like, I kind of walk quickly. And so the clown became, this kind of Chaplin-esque walk became exaggerated. I'm a writer. I can be kind of heady, right? And I can be kind of anxious. And so the clown then becomes this person who's kind of always, his eyes are always darting around and kind of trying to figure out what's happening. Trying to be in control all the time. Mm-hmm. And then the neat thing is then putting your inner clown in relationship with another inner clown. So my partner was an actor. He's actually based in Philadelphia now. And he had this kind of, you know, big actor persona, and that got even more exaggerated. So you had this kind of nervous writer type with this big actor type, and that created the laughs.
And when you develop the acts, is it part improv? Is it do you sit down and you write something, or do you get on the stage together and you do something?
There's lots of different ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of it's improv, and trying to find something that's interesting and unique. We were really text heavy, so we had and this is another point to make about the circus arts now, is that each of the circus arts, you can have full-length shows. So Jerome Thomas, the juggler we were talking about earlier, does an hour and a half long juggling show where it's just juggling. It's like a dance show. It's like a theater show. In our case, we had an hour and a half long clown show. So when we had a script, so there was a period after we did the improvisations where we wrote the script. We did lots and lots of revisions, and then we really tried to fine-tune it. So the way you would mm-hmm. fine-tune any kind of piece of theater or writing.
And it's interesting you say, you know, when I think of circus artists, I always think of them as being silent. You don't hear them speak. Is that changing? Is Jerome Thomas ever speaking while juggling?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's you know, there's lots of people who are thinking about the role of language in circus now. Clowns have always spoken, for the record. There's always been this notion of clown. But other, you know, now the first show I saw, the show that blew me away, they were actually quoting Proust as part of the show. They were singing Simon and Garfunkel. There's a sense of having a relationship. Another kind of famous company now from Montreal, Seven Fingers of the Hand, one of the things they'll do is they'll actually have the performers introduce themselves. So it's like, you know, hi, my name is George, you know, I'm an acrobat. And you kind of develop a personal relationship, like I grew up in St. Louis, et cetera, develop a personal relationship with this person, so that when you then see them do this double backflip, it's like, whoa, it's not just somebody, it's a person.
But is the circus performer, do they still carry the same mystique that they once did? You know, it was people that you never got to meet. You got to see them and then they moved on. Now somebody is your neighbor and you're a circus performer. So do you think that people still have that kind of the edge? Or are they more like everybody's mom or
I think it's funny. I think it's they have it initially, right? Mm-hmm. So when I say I'm a circus guy or there's a relationship to the circus, there's always the kind of like, whoa, what's going on? Wow, that's crazy, right? And then you kind of talk about it and they get familiar with it, and that does start to fade. It's getting to the point now where circus is becoming so integrated into society that it's lost a little bit of that sense of, you know, run away with the circus. But no, there's still something. There's still a kind of romantic dream.
And there's probably also that kind of brother and sisterhood of circus performers that we see among actors and people who have the same passion.
Absolutely. I mean, it's even possibly, some people say it's stronger in the circus than other places because there's this notion of working together and trust, right? So if you and I are doing a hand balancing act and I'm sort of holding you above my head, right, we're going to have a pretty quick bond with each other because I'm supporting you, because you literally are on top of me. It's in the trapeze, that's especially strong, but it's really there in all of the circus arts, the notion of I'm helping you, you're helping me, we come out of it together.
But there has to be a sense of competition, too.
Oh, there is, sure. I mean, but if you think about how a circus show is structured, right, it's not like a sport. Each artist is doing their own thing, and they're all contributing to make the show. So it's hard for, like, a clown to compete with a juggler, or a juggler to compete with an aerialist, right, because it's so dramatically different worlds, and that, you know, diminishes a lot of that.
And before we have to go, what is the state of the circus arts in the U.S.? You are in Canada now, but what about us here in the U.S.?
It's interesting. So in the 70s, basically, when things blew up here everywhere, it didn't blow up into performance art in America as much because there's less government funding. And that's starting to change now, and we're working to make it change, hopefully.
All right, and that's Duncan Wall. He has written a new book called The Ordinary Acrobat about his time in France learning the circus arts and also about the history of the circus, and we want to thank you so much for being here today.
It's your pleasure.
All right, Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder, and we've had help this week from Emily Bryant. Our engineer has been Kevin Griffin. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain. Marty will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend, and thank you so much for listening.